Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Lawsuits against Sheriff Arpaio and MCSO have climbed into the millions over the years. So how does a county or other municipality find the balance on an agency enforcing the law and the economics of the outcome? Kathy Barnes, professor of law at the U of A, joins me. Kathy, what is the balance point for enforcing the law while also being aware of the possible economic consequences?
Law enforcement in general has the requirements to enforce the law. They have a fair amount of discretion in how they do that, and they really do have to, in deciding on using that discretion, they really do have to pay attention to both what parts, how to keep people safe in general, and how to do that without violating people's rights, which is actually sometimes a hard balance to make.
Is there something that, when it comes to running an agency that large and knowing that the law has to be followed in a sense, is that something that has to come from the top down? Is that something where, in this case, a sheriff would need to make sure that people in his department know what the law is and know that they can only go so far in enforcing it, for example?
I mean, that is, in essence, the sheriff's job, is that it's his job to make sure that everyone in his organization knows what the law is and knows how and knows how far they can go and what they can't do.
And what about if we put it in the greater sense of the phrase, the cost of doing business, in essence? Because the supervisors here in Maricopa County are, at least when it comes to budgetary situations, are his boss, basically. They can sort of decide. When it comes to law enforcement, are lawsuits kind of built into the cost of doing business as well, thinking that at some point there's going to have to be something available in case the county in this case runs into situations?
Law enforcement in general, I do think that there is a cost of doing business with having lawsuits, that that organizations are not perfect, and that, you know, and that the people that encompass them aren't perfect, and therefore there are going to be mistakes, and there are going to be lawsuits over time. I think that, as a broad matter, is very different from what's happening in Maricopa County, which is almost this is the cost of doing business because Sheriff Arpaio takes high risks and sort of pushes the envelope and pushes too far in many, many cases. And this has been a cost of doing business for him, in some sense, for Maricopa County for years. This is not the first brush with large lawsuits that he has had.
I guess at what point can the county say, well, we're not going to stand behind you? I mean, can they put a line in the sand and say, well, based on the fact that you have cost the county this certain amount of money, we're going to cut back your budget? I mean, is that something that they could use? Or do they, in essence, because they're representing the same area, the same community, they sort of have to be on the same page?
I think it's difficult for them to do that because they have, you know, these are the lawsuits are lawsuits that they have to pay as, you know, as their you know, the money is from the county. It's to the county, not to the sheriff's, you know, it's not just the sheriff's office. And so the only way that they could do that is by somehow having Sheriff Arpaio out of office, or alternatively, just cutting the budget so much that you end up cutting, you know, things other than the lawsuit, since the lawsuit is what you absolutely, you know, is something you have to pay. And I don't think anybody wants, you know, sort of the underlying law enforcement to be so constricted over time. So I think they're in a really hard place.
Kathy Barnes is a professor of law at the University of Arizona. The long security lines at Sky Harbor Airport are in effect again today, and that's not a unique situation for major metropolitan airports. And if you're planning on flying for a summer vacation, plan on long waits as well. That's a big part of why some big cities are making noise about getting rid of the TSA and looking into hiring private firms. Phoenix has been one of those. Here's Deborah Ostreicher, Assistant Aviation Director for the city.
We have to consider every option available to make these tenable, not just tenable, but acceptable and friendly.
Joining me with more insight on the developments is Bart Jansen, who covers transportation issues for USA Today. Bart, what are the most significant TSA-related concerns that some of these big city airports have?
One is there was an Inspector General report last summer that found that the checkpoint officers weren't finding guns and mock explosives very well at the checkpoints. And that was upsetting to TSA officials, and so they put everybody through a training program and insisted that they take a much closer look at people going through the line. So there is tighter security this year. In addition, they've reduced the number of people selected randomly to go through expedited screening. It used to be that if you were in a line and there was a long line at one checkpoint, they might just pick you out randomly to go through the faster line, known as pre-check. That's no longer happening unless there is a canine unit that sniffs for explosives along the regular line. Then those people that have had a canine unit can go into the expedited line. So in addition to those two things that are tightening security, TSA is also projecting 8% more people traveling this summer. It's just the economy is continuing to grow, more people are traveling, and so there are more people at the checkpoints at the same time that security is getting tighter. And over the last 3 years, TSA has about 5,000 fewer screeners.
Bart, what about what New York Senator Chuck Schumer had to say over the weekend about getting more bomb-sniffing dogs involved? Was that just an idea that was floated? Has that been talked about a lot?
TSA is increasing the number of bomb-sniffing dogs that they have. They have a couple of hundred of these teams. They take much longer to train. They take maybe a year to train, in contrast to the checkpoint officers, who I believe is just a couple of months to train. What they have done in some of the trouble spots so far, Seattle, Minneapolis, and other places that have seen 2-hour waits or longer during spring break, is they have shifted dog teams from smaller airports to get them to those busy and congested airports. And so, for example, Maui lost a dog team and it got shifted to Minneapolis. The advantage is, and I think they shifted a couple of dog teams to Minneapolis so that they have a total of, I think, about six now. If you have a dog team, as I said, going up and down a regular security line, then all of the people in that line, once they've been checked and they are found to be not carrying explosives on their person or in their carry-on bags, then they can be moved into the pre-check line where you get to keep on your shoes, you can leave the laptop in the bag, you can leave your containers of small liquids in the bag. It's just a faster way to get people through, and that can shorten lines. The problem is there aren't enough dog teams to go around to reduce all the lines.
And Bart, when we hear a city like Phoenix, and we've heard it from other cities as well, I believe Atlanta was one also, that make noise about the frustration with the TSA and even say, you know, we'd like to, in essence, fire the TSA. Is that even doable, or is that just sort of people complaining?
It's absolutely possible, but it's not something that's going to solve the problem this summer for you. When Congress created federal screening, which happened after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, they allowed airports to opt out if they show that they are screening passengers and luggage at the same tough standards as TSA provides. So today, there are 22 airports nationwide that have private screeners under contract that are overseen, that the standards are overseen by TSA, but it's a private contractor, it's a private workforce. It's hard for travelers to tell the difference, but if you've ever been through San Francisco Airport or Kansas City's airport, those are two of the larger airports that have these private screeners.
Bart Jansen covers transportation for USA Today. Bart, thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show today. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. The North Carolina House Bill 2, the bathroom bill, has been a national issue. It's pitted the state and the U.S. Justice Department over the issue of discrimination against the transgender community.
But the bill also contains language to limit or curtail attempts by local governments to raise their minimum wages and to make it easier for employers to fire employees who might later claim discrimination. These pro-business provisions anger Wendy May, a Democratic candidate for county commissioner in Johnston County, North Carolina. Wendy, what do you think?
North Carolina has made a hate bill, which most people are identifying as the bathroom bill, but it is a lot more than just a bathroom bill. It takes my right as a transgender person away. It violates my civil rights to use the bathroom that I identify with. And it also puts the light shining on me when I go to the bathroom. I have been lucky. I haven't had any episodes yet, but prior to this law, no one even knew that transgenders were using bathrooms. People didn't even know what a transgender was.
So how is this law, this hate bill, as you term it, created a wedge to actually also limit the minimum wage in the state of North Carolina?
Well, you know, it's funny. I hate that word, first of all, minimum wage. I like livable wage or a living wage much better. In Johnston County, where I live, it's a very rural county. So an hourly wage for one adult at poverty level here is $5 an hour. But one adult and one child, it's $7 an hour here. When you start adding more children, the poverty wage goes up a little. So an adult and two children is $9. As we know, the minimum wage here is $7.25. The living wage, or the wage that actually is what is required to live in Johnston County, a rural county, for one adult is $10.98. So what has happened here is there has been movements, living wage projects, to try to bring awareness to living wages.
But this bill would basically turn those initiatives or render them null and void, even if Johnson County was to try to raise its minimum wage to a living wage. Is that what you're saying?
The way this law is written, yes. This law was put into effect to try to stop these movements of living wage projects. It's like the rest of this. This is a four-part bill. The General Assembly does not have the ability to regulate the employment practice of local government, even though they think they do. So I think anyone that has a living wage ordinance will survive as long as it directly affects only their governmental employees. And they've never had the ability, and never hopefully ever will, to tell a private employer what it can do.
So this bill affects bathrooms, it affects living wage initiatives. What are the other two elements in this bill that are offensive in your view?
Well, the whole bill is offensive because it discriminates. It eliminates any state law claim for wrongful termination of employee based upon color of the person's skin, where they're from, if they're a Christian or not. It affects everyone. That's the problem that most people don't realize, because the General Assembly and the governor use the transgender community as a smokescreen. Let's get everybody hyped up about, oh my God, some man is going to dress as a woman and go into the girls' room. Because it's not what happens. It's not what people do.
And there are already laws against them anyway.
There's already laws to protect people in a bathroom. Like I said, this is a bill looking for a problem that doesn't exist.
Wendy May, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Wendy May is a candidate for county commission in Johnston County, North Carolina.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. A town's anger and frustration over perceived racial profiling and a police shooting boiled up recently.
Discrimination must stop.
Yeah.
This isn't Cleveland, Baltimore, or New York, but a small rural town in northern Arizona. The protesters here want justice for a Native American woman shot and killed by a white officer. They're also asking questions about who polices them and how. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laura Morales reports.
Department of Public Safety authorities gave this account of the shooting. On March 27th, Winslow Police Officer Austin Shipley responded to a report of shoplifting at a local convenience store. When Shipley tried to arrest L'Oreal Synogeny, she threatened him with scissors. Shipley then fired five shots at Synogeny, killing her. Floranda Dempsey is Synogeny's aunt.
You know, she didn't deserve to be shot down five times. I mean, who was he to be the judge, the juror, and the executioner.
The Arizona DPS is still investigating the shooting, but the Associated Press reports that documents they obtained say two officers who trained Shipley told the Winslow Police Department he shouldn't be kept on the force. He was too quick to go for his gun, ignored orders, and falsified reports.
If there's somebody that has questionable background, don't put him on the force, for God's sake, you know?
That's Navajo President Russell Begay. He says there are bigger problems. Too many non-Native police officers in towns bordering the Navajo Nation, and
they need to make sure that we have people on those forces that do not discriminate against my people, the Navajos.
Here are the facts. The Winslow Police Department has 5 Native American officers out of 22. 70% of the town's population is Native American. Just east of Winslow is Holbrook, another Navajo border town. 0 Native American officers. And in Flagstaff, there is 1 Native American officer out of 112. Police Chief Kevin Treadway says for the last 3 years, he's invested heavily in recruiting Native Americans.
I feel very strongly that our agency needs to look like the community that we serve.
A Flagstaff police recruiter has gone to job fairs on the reservation, placed ads in the Navajo Times, and posted jobs with Native American networks. But according to interviews with a number of police chiefs, the applicants they see often have drug or domestic abuse records or don't pass the rigorous tests. Here's Holbrook Police Chief Mark Jackson.
I've had plenty of Native Americans in here, but a lot of them just don't make it past that background check.
The lack of Native American officers leads to another problem, as Navajo President Begay put it, the need for a force that doesn't discriminate. In Flagstaff in 2014, 45% of arrests made were Native American offenders. Census data show only 12% of Flagstaff's population is Native American. Keep in mind, the census doesn't include the many Native American visitors and homeless. But other border towns where data are available show the same trend, many more Native Americans arrested than other groups. Flagstaff's Kevin Treadway says that 45%, those aren't all unique arrests. Many are repeat offenders. All the more reason to stress consistency and fairness among officers.
So I think in any agency, the culture of that department is just incredibly important.
Flagstaff PD has policies in place prohibiting racial profiling. Also, for the last 2 years, all officers have worn body cameras, and footage called into question and complaints are investigated and vetted through the chain of command.
And so the question is, how do you develop a culture that is absolutely resistant and intolerant of racial profiling?
Holbrook Police Chief Mark Jackson questions whether it's even possible.
You know, young officers that come out of the academy, they're high strung. Academy teaches you, everybody's out to kill you.
The Navajo Nation has asked the U.S. Justice Department to investigate racist police practices in Winslow. Federal officials have said they cannot look into it until the state investigation is complete. That report is due at the end of the month. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into the piece that you did. How has the community reacted to the shooting in Winslow?
Well, L'Oreal Sinogeny's aunt says many people have come forward to her and to other family members with stories of discrimination of their own with border town police. And on top of that, the Navajo president, Begay, he says that there's always been discriminatory practices and attitudes in border towns with the police and others. And the Navajo Council has asked the Justice Department, their Civil Rights Division, to investigate excessive use of force in border towns. That's towns bordering the Navajo Nation, just like it has the Justice Department did with Ferguson, Missouri.
And has the federal government responded to the request?
They have. They cannot look into it yet. They have to wait for the state's investigation to be complete. And a federal official did come out to Winslow and spoke at a recent meeting. He explained to them, the community members that came out, both Winslow residents and Navajo members, that the DOJ would be looking at two main things, pattern
and practice. In other words, tribal members, they'll have to prove that they were stopped, arrested, or harassed by border town police, and that those incidents were motivated by race.
Now, one thing you say in your story is that the police have had trouble recruiting Navajo officers. So what more could they do to recruit Native officers? And then how could the tribe help, too?
Yeah, so the police departments, they can go to job fairs on the reservation. They can post ads in the Navajo Times. I know that the Flagstaff PD and Page PD has already done this. In Holbrook, where they have no Native American officers, the Holbrook police chief, he was pretty blunt in saying, if the Navajo president wants more Native American officers in his community, then the tribe needs to help him, you know, share lists of eligible candidates and host job fairs, invite the police departments from the surrounding areas to come.
And are some of the border towns we're talking about doing more than others when it comes to the vetting and training process to try to avoid a situation like what happened in Winslow?
Yeah, it does seem to be different depending on who you talk to. For example, in Flagstaff, Page, and Farmington, they were definitely the most proactive. But, you know, Page doesn't have cultural sensitivity training. Both Flagstaff and Page, the people I talked to there, agreed that your police should represent the community you serve. But that's easier said than done. In Holbrook, Winslow, and Cortez, they were the least proactive. Holbrook's police chief, along with Page and Flagstaff, said that once that investigation report is out, once DPS releases that, they'll use that with their officers to debrief with them and to learn from what happened. And then one of the most important things I think that came out of all of this, that came out of my reporting, was that the Flagstaff Police Chief Kevin Treadway, when I spoke with him, he said no matter what color your officers are, you have to build a culture where racial profiling is not tolerated.
And I guess the million-dollar question then is, how do you do that?
So I spoke with NAU professor Frederick Gooding Jr., and he says that staying connected with all members of the community, you know, the police officers have to live in the community and build relationships with all walks of life so that there's a trust there both ways.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Laurel, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
Today, to celebrate the working life and the first Monday of the show on your news and information station, we're looking at the people who do the jobs that you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around the valley that might not be what you expect. Today, we step into the water with a day on the job at SRP's fish herding project for the Valley's canal system.
My name's Jeff Adams. I am the supervisor over biochemical applications here for Salt River Project. We have 131 miles of canal, and so we stock a fish called the white aimer, which is a common grass carp, and it eats the vegetation for us and allows the water to flow freely to our customers. Right now we're working at 75th Avenue and Camelback in Phoenix. We'll be moving these fish over to 35th Avenue and the Grand Canal, which is just north of Osborne. So within the canal, in order to herd the fish, we have just your standard horse fence that allows us to corral the fish and move them, because obviously we can't just will a fish where it needs to go. We gotta help them. So we put them in a fence and we corral them to a particular area, and we have a large excavator, and it's attached to a net that we use where we load the fish into before we load them onto large dump trucks that have fish tanks that are oxygenated. It takes about a mile a day that we can move fish. In our canals, we get a large amount of sediment buildup, trash buildup. It clogs up our delivery channels, so we have to get in there and clean up the canals. If we do not, then our gates get shut off, and we can't. There's no way to deliver water to our customers. It usually takes anywhere from 18 to 20 people to effectively herd the fish. It's a very tiring job. It's very laborsome. There's a lot of trash, debris you're fighting with in the canals. You know, the water's cold. Feels like you're running a marathon all day long because just your legs are burning. The muscles are just on fire. How deep are you guys right here in the mud?
Oh, this mud's about up to my knee.
About knee. A lot of people ask, well, why can't you just get rid of the fish and start with new ones? Well, kind of like a parent teaches a child, the older fish will teach the young fish where to stay. Otherwise, they'll all move downstream and they won't eat the vegetation throughout the canal. So that's why we have to move the older fish back upstream so they'll keep the new fish that we do stock in once we get done back in those same areas.
That's Jeff Adams working with SRP in the irrigation canals. We'll have a few more conversations about somebody's job this week. It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Phil Latzman. As the debate rages on over whether the U.S. Senate should grant confirmation hearings to President Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland, there's also judicial drama playing out here in Arizona.
This is the executive making a power grab over the judiciary.
That's Democratic State Senator Steve Farley. He's talking about the bill that expands the Arizona Supreme Court from 5 justices to 7. Farley says 5 is plenty, and making it 7 is a purely political move by a GOP-dominated state leadership.
So I ask myself, what's the reason? Why are we doing this? And it strikes me the only reason why you would add justices to the court is to pack the court for political reasons.
But Republican John Kavanaugh gives the example of Vermont, with a tenth of Arizona's population, which also has a 5-justice court.
To be on the same level as Vermont, we actually have to add 43 more justices, but we're only going to add 2.
State Representative J.D. Mesnard says he believes a larger state high court is appropriate, but he conceded that separating politics from policy is impossible with a Republican governor in Doug Ducey.
There's always going to be a political consideration, and if there were a Democrat on the 9th floor, that would be a political consideration that I would take into account.
Mark Harrison has been taking the political consideration into account. He's been practicing law in the Valley for over 5 decades and is past president of the State Bar of Arizona. He's currently serving as the national chair of the nonpartisan group Justice at Stake.
If you look back in history, when President Roosevelt tried to pack the court in the late 30s, leading Democrats in the Senate precluded him from doing that. Senators who opposed it recognized that it would do damage to the institution as an institution. And that's my concern about this.
So, Mark, why do you feel, as a nonpartisan observer, that this is indeed court packing by the GOP here in Arizona?
It's not supposed to intentionally reflect the views of one party or the other. And I would be saying this if the governor were a Democrat now, and this bill was before a Democratic governor. It's just not good policy. And if the governor appoints 2 more justices who are Republicans and presumably ideologically compatible with the governor's views, that would mean that 6 out of 7 judges on the Supreme Court are Republican appointees. And that, of course, would undermine the public perception about whether this court is really balanced, diverse, both in terms of political philosophy and color, and impartial.
Proponents of this say no matter who the governor is and whatever his party is, that caseloads are simply too high in a state of 6 million people. And for instance, the lawmakers who sponsor this bill give the example of Vermont, which is a state of 600,000 people. It has 5 justices as well. So does Arizona need more justices on the Supreme Court to handle the caseload, in your experience?
In my experience, no, but more specifically and more pertinent, the Chief Justice has said that we're managing the caseload fine and we don't need, as a matter of essential need, additional justices. The fact is that the present 5-person court is handling the caseload on a current basis, and he said, he testified and told the legislature that as a matter of need, this is not necessary.
How do we pay for these extra 2 justices?
That's clearly above my pay grade. I don't know how we're going to pay for them, but the irony of it, of course, is that this is a legislature which is ostensibly conservative, ostensibly trying to keep the budget to essentials. This is clearly not an essential expenditure. And so it's hypocrisy at its best to suggest that we need this when it's going to cost money that could be used for things like education, child welfare, the list goes on and on. This is certainly not one of those essential things that the legislature needs to be spending $1 million on if that's what they're spending. Moreover, My understanding is that the Chief Justice was ambivalent about this. He testified that it wasn't needed, literally needed as a matter of keeping up with the caseload, but agreed to it on the condition that the legislature would provide desperately needed funding for the courts, for judicial pay raises, for upgrades in technology, for additional parole and probation officers. And my understanding, and I don't know the facts at this point, but my understanding generally is that the legislature has not surprisingly reneged on that commitment and is now giving the court a lot less than the Chief Justice expected it would receive in exchange for his not opposing this bill.
Mark Harrison is a partner at the law firm Osborne Maladon PA here in Phoenix. He's also past president of the State Bar of Arizona and is current president of the organization Justice at Stake. Thanks, Mr. Harrison, very much for your time.
Thank you, Phil. Take care.
The Yarnell Hill Fire was one of the most tragic days in the history of American firefighting. 19 Prescott-based Granite Mountain hotshots were killed when the blaze trapped them, and rescuers were unable to help. In her new book, The Fire Line, Fernanda Santos of the New York Times writes about what happened with the fire, the men who attempted to fight it, and their surviving family members. And she joins me now to talk about it. Fernanda, would we be right in characterizing wildland firefighters as people who need to be in the middle of dangerous action helping protect communities?
I think in some ways it is a true assessment of who they are. There is an element that I think is a commonality among all these guys who each have their own personal histories and different life experiences. And that is that they all love the outdoors. They are not people who are built to work within the confines of an office. And so while they did the job very seriously, took very seriously the role they had in a fire, their role in protecting communities and lives, they also enjoyed it in a way that's much greater than you and I may enjoy our jobs. They loved being dirty for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. They loved the ability to go to places that people like you and I don't usually go to. So they were thrill seekers, but that's not what drives them to do that job.
Let's go back to those days in late June of 2013. You made the reference to working 2 weeks at a time. What sort of state or condition were these hotshots in when they faced their greatest challenge? Were they physically and mentally ready for that?
Well, it's sort of hard for me to say exactly how they were feeling. I think that, you know, it's not just your physical exhaustion that plays a role. And you mentioned, were they mentally ready? Well, sometimes you may be on the first day of your run, but you leave home and you have an argument with your wife. And there goes your mental stability for that day, right? You know, they were on the 14th day of a 14-day run, so they have to take a mandatory day off after that. This was a fire that started out as a small fire, a fire that was deemed a fire of no great concern on Friday night when it started. And for that reason, there was no aggressive effort to put it out. It was also a fire that kept dodging the crews that eventually got up on the mountain on Saturday, June 29th. And the reason hotshot crews are called into fires is because they are the most trained among the hand crews. And they also work closest to the fire. So the idea is you put these guys out there, and if nobody else can do the job, the hotshots can do it.
Did it feel like this was a system failure, this was a planning failure, or this was simply Mother Nature doing something unexpected?
Absolutely not just Mother Nature doing something unexpectedly. Obviously, the storm played a big role, right? The fire was moving north. The storm came from the opposite direction with very strong winds that literally hooked the flames and turned them around. People described the flames doing a horseshoe in the air. And the flames then went the direction where the crew was. My goal when I started this research was not so much to find blame or to assign blame to one person or one incident, because I honestly believe that even if somebody made a decision that was not the best decision at the time, and there was more than one person who, in my opinion, made a decision that was not optimal, it's hard to say that that person is to blame for what happened for that, that person alone carries the blame. And the reason is that in the job of firefighting in general, nobody makes a decision that's predicated on the possibility of death. So whereas we can turn around and Monday morning quarterback everything that happened, you know, they didn't have the luxury of time to sit and really evaluate whether it really made sense to do the things they did. So it was a combination of things. I think a failure of the system, a failure of very tight connections among the people on the leadership of the fire. One has to blame, and I use this word very carefully, the crew itself, because they made the decision to go down. Yeah. But again, a decision that I believe was made based on the best information they had and a belief that this was the right course of action at that time.
Will the Granite Mountain Hotshots be remembered as heroes?
I don't think of them as heroes. I grew up watching Superman. I grew up watching Wonder Woman. You know, these people with magical powers would come flying out of nowhere. The journalist who would turn into a flying superhero who would save everybody who was in trouble. They were obviously not those kind of people. So they are heroes because they had the selflessness to do a job that requires a lot of courage for anyone to do. I like to think of them as people like you and I, people who had passions, one of them for fighting fires, and who died doing a job they loved and who chose to stay together until the end. None of them ran when that wave of fire came their way. Mm-hmm. So they made a decision that if they were going to get out, they were going to get out of it together. And that, to me, is what I hope will be the lasting image of them, the culture of loyalty that they shared.
Fernanda Santos of the New York Times. We've been talking about the Granite Mountain Hotshots and her new book, The Fire Line. Fernanda, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm your host, Steve Goldstein.
Steve, could you hold still, please?
Oh, it's Jimmy Jenkins. Sorry, Jimmy, but I'm actually trying to host the show here.
Yeah, but I'm trying to sketch your profile, and I can't get it right if you keep moving around.
Okay, let me take a look here. That's not very good. I mean, it's a stick figure.
Well, look, I'm just getting into this, okay? I was inspired.
Oh, all right. By my dashing good looks?
No, Steve. While you are certainly dashing, I talked to a young artist I want to introduce you to. Her name's Marika Davis. She's a drawing major at ASU working on a new graphic novel.
I'm just a beginner at this point, but I base a lot on Scott McCloud's How to Draw Comics. I use a standard Micron ink pens and pencils and kind of in a noir style.
Now, she's kind of underselling herself here, Steve. She's been studying drawing pretty much her whole life. When she was younger, she had 3 brain surgeries that affected her vision. And so drawing was a way to work on a recovery.
Art was very therapeutic for me. It helped me move my eyes around, helped me get used to my impairment. But even before my surgeries, I was pretty good at it, and I wanted to continue it. It's just a matter of adapting.
Marika has hemianopsia, which means she has half of the field of vision in both eyes. So when she reads, it's hard for her to track across a page. But there is one form of writing that she can read really well.
The reason why I love comics so much is because it's in a bubble. It's in a finite area. I can read that without any audio assistance or anyone reading to me. I found that comics could be so much more than just, you know, people punching each other. It can be philosophical. It could be could have elements of mythology, and that just really fascinated me.
So comics and graphic novels have become this perfect medium for her to express her art. But she says she definitely thinks it's an area that could use a new perspective.
I see comics differently. Majority of them tend to be quite sexist or just very male-centered, and I wanted to create my own comic that could include more women characters and also deal with issues that women face.
So, Jimmy, we shouldn't expect a bunch of men in tights saving the day.
Right. Marika's graphic novel is called Ember Black, and the main character is a 22-year-old woman. But she says that's about where the similarities with the author end.
She's a rather cynical 22-year-old. She's also very protective of her little sister, Amy. But when her sister is kidnapped by this cult-like group and Emily is left for dead, she becomes possessed by an evil spirit called a Wendigo, which is from Algonquin lore. And this is actually a cannibal spirit. But since this the spirit can't live without Emily, and Emily can't live without it, they have to kind of learn to work together and also try and find her sister.
Well, it sounds like your standard Algonquin spirit cannibal story to me, Jimmy.
Tale as old as time. But Marika has taken a new approach for this project, too. She commissioned and directed a cast to produce an audio component so that people like her with a vision impairment can experience the story as well.
We open with a full, half blood red moon hanging in the night sky. But the moon is just a reflection in a puddle that ripples as a young woman runs by. She is in her early 20s, barefoot, with shoulder-length light brown frizzy hair. She looks back, fearfully, over her shoulder and straight at us.
I would really like to hope that people don't just discount people with visual impairments, that because we don't have your vision, that automatically limits us to what we can do in life.
So, Steve, she's drawing and inking this all by hand, and she still has a few panels left, but we've got some storyboards that she shared with us on our website, theshow.kjzz.org, and she hopes to have the graphic novel and audiobook published this fall.
The show's Jimmy Jenkins talking with artist Marika Davis about her upcoming graphic novel, Ember Black. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
The desert has often been associated with mystery and the unknown, and many people have come here for some sort of spiritual awakening. And sometimes your mind just gets blown. That's what happened to MIT physicist Frank Wilczek when he saw the Bruce Munro Sonoran Light exhibit at the Desert Botanical Gardens, and he joins me to talk about what he experienced. Frank, describe what you saw in these balls of color set against the desert.
The colors would change slowly with time. And these things covered the whole hillsides, and the patterns were constantly changing, and the kind of rhythm of them was comparable to the rhythm of a heartbeat or the rhythm of breathing, so it seemed very organic. And here, there in the dark with these lights going off and on, I really sort of entered a different state of consciousness. It just made me think very differently from everyday life, somehow, being immersed in this very unusual environment. Because I've spent over my lifetime plenty of time thinking about brains and firing patterns and what they might mean, it was very natural for me to when seeing this kind of thing, it called to mind ideas about images, movies I've seen of nerves firing and of things like flashes of insight, or you know, when somebody has a great idea, sometimes you see a light bulb go off in their head. Somehow, all those things came together. I don't know myself exactly how it was, but in this very relaxed kind of uninhibited state of consciousness, I suddenly thought that I was seeing how minds work. I could see that there are so many combinations. I was experiencing it. It's one thing to think about it abstractly. It's quite a different thing to kind of experience it. This is what it is. This is what it looks like.
Are there certain environments in which that is more likely to occur or to actually be able to present itself in a way that we can at least ponder more?
What I've found is, okay, when I'm working on some technical problem, I may work all day thinking about equations and learning the background material, looking at the literature, talking to people, but then typically you get stuck. but you keep at it. But then it's important, I think, just to relax and take a walk, do something else. And somehow the subconscious is working all the while. When you're really immersed in something, your subconscious is working all the while, and it's less inhibited somehow. It's not as finicky about logic, and you can connect processing to seeing. And that somehow these periods of intense concentration interspersed with looser kind of thinking is what's worked well for me in important cases.
Had you been at the Botanical Gardens before?
Yeah, a few times, but mostly during the Bruce Munro exhibition is a temporary exhibition. I hadn't seen that before, and usually go there during the day when you can see the plants better.
Right, right.
Of course.
There's a different dynamic. There's a different sort of feel to the desert, even in the nighttime. Was there any feeling of that you experienced as well, or was it really focused on the Monroe exhibit? Was there anything around it, maybe just the darkness and the stars?
Well, I mean, the exhibit, the desert certainly facilitated it because the air was very clear, and there wasn't a lot of plant life obscuring the vision, the sight lines, so you could see the different lights. So the exhibit could be on a very large scale, and it, you could see it all, and experience and get immersed in it, which wouldn't have been possible in a more densely, with more dense foliage or in moist air that would distort the image of faraway objects. So yeah, it certainly helped. And there's something about the clarity of the desert air, also something about the horizon.
So since that experience in late January, have you noticed anything? Have you found more clarity in other aspects of your work? Did that end up opening up sort of a portal in your mind? Has it manifested itself in that sense in any sort of practical way since then?
I couldn't really honestly say yes in any concrete way. I feel my mind has been expanded, and I hope eventually it will lead to new ways of thinking about thinking and so forth. But it's become part of the toolbox, so to speak, some of the part of my brain, but I haven't yet brought it to bear on anything else in a significant way. It'll happen, but things take time.
Physicist and Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek of MIT talking about what he felt at the Desert Botanical Garden's Sonoran Light exhibit. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.